Welcome to the full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:01 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 31st, the last day of the month, and also it's Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought I'd kick off this week and look at the Shiller PE ratio, because there's been a fair amount of commentary with the fact that it is it's at its second highest level ever. So it's above the 1929 peak, it's below the peak that we saw in 1999, and it is continuing to expand. That's against the background where earnings are breaking out. We have that a much longer term chart than is available on Bloomberg on this multiple.com site. So, but it very clearly indicates that we have earnings breaking out to new all-time highs. And earnings now are considerably above where they were in 2000. And of course, that has helped to contain the multiple, such as it is right now, even if it is at the second highest level in history. That higher earnings ratio has, or part of the ratio, has helped to contain the valuation. But that doesn't mean that valuations aren't rising. Well, we know why valuations have been rising. It's because US treasuries have been so low for so long. And the yield today is, or this week, is firming from the region of the trend mean. It's continuing to hold between about 2.8 and 3%. It's been doing that now for most of this year. The last time it ranged anywhere close to this kind of amplitude was back in 2013, immediately after the taper tantrum. And the big question, and it is an awfully big question, is in what direction is this going to break? Well, we still have the progression of higher reaction lows, but there is a progression of lower rally highs as well from the failed break that we saw in April above the 3% level. So then I think we need to look at some other, I think, intelligence to really give us some indication of which way things are likely to go. We know, for example, that there is a great deal of additional supply that's going to be coming to the market, and that represents a headwind in any other market, and bonds are certainly no, exception to this rule. When you get a surge of supply, then it has a deleterious effect on price, which should shove up the yield. But at the same time, there are troubles elsewhere in the world, and low interest rates elsewhere in the world that are acting as a source of demand on a relative basis for US treasuries. So that has helped to contain yields over the course of the last 8 months. So there are two arguments, and the very fact that it is ranging tells us that the arguments are in equilibrium, that supply and demand are back in a relative balance, and it is going to require some form of catalytic event in order to either send yields higher or indeed lower. And we're not there yet in terms of that kind of catalytic event. I think particularly interesting to keep an eye on the TIPS yields, because while we have the argument about the quantity of additional bonds that are going to be issued by the Treasury, there aren't any additional issuances of TIPS that are likely in the next year to 18 months. So if we then look at the chart that we're presented with the TIPS, well, it's been ranging below 1% since 2013, and there has been a mild upward bias to the yield over the course of the last 2 years. If, in fact, it does break on the upside, well, then that would be a categorical vote in favor of an inflationary outcome. But again, this has been a very inert range. Certainly, it has been able to support the continued bounces from the region of the trend mean, and that is representative of people looking for hedges. They're looking for hedges both from an inflationary perspective, but also the fact that this is not nearly as a supply-dominated environment. If, in fact, this were to break higher, it would be, I think, representative of inflation winning out. And when we think about what it is that is going on in terms of the U.S. economy, well, it is growing strongly. There is a Well, unemployment is quite low. Something that we've seen is that in the small post office down the road from us, that there's been an enormous turnover of staff. They can't seem to hold anybody for more than about 2 months, and they're paying about $13 an hour and having a great deal of difficulty holding staff. Well, that's obviously a reflection of a tight labor market, that people can go elsewhere and get a better wage or better conditions. So I think it is only a matter of time before we start to see wages starting to move higher, and that is directly inflationary. So again, we're probably not there just yet, but it does look increasingly likely that if this were to break, it's going to break on the upside. Then, if that's indeed the case, that we're in this sort of sweet spot right now between when inflationary factors in fact do appear, and when those measure, when of course they appear, then the Federal Reserve will probably be under greater pressure to implement tightening policies. But the S&P 500 has broken out to a new all-time high, and so far it has held that advance. It was particularly inert over the last 2 days, but the most important characteristic is that it has broken out to new highs, and so far that advance has been sustained. Well, there is also 180 odd point overextension relative to the trend mean, so it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we may get some pause in consolidation over the next few weeks. But the fact that it is already at a new high, that it is following the Nasdaq 100 higher, and that the Nasdaq has extended its advance in here today, and the Nasdaq is obviously representative of the mega cap technology shares, but the Russell 2000 is more representative of the domestic US economy, and that also has been a lead and broke out last week and improved upon that performance this week. So there is the realistic possibility that we can start to talk about the third psychological perception stage here, that people are bringing money in off the sidelines. There is a real fear starting to evolve of missing out. That when we look at the very large cap shares like Apple, that there is no getting around the fact that the share is accelerating. It has done spectacularly well over the course of the last 5 weeks, and it was up again in here today. Amazon looks likely to follow Apple up to a $1 trillion valuation, and it was up and through the $2,000 level in here this week, and it is now not far off $500 overextended relative to the trend mean, which is approximately 25%. So it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we could have some pause in consolidation. In fact, that would be rather healthy. If it continues to accelerate from here, well, then we really are talking about some significant trend-ending characteristics. But it's not just Apple and Amazon. Google, which has had one of the more consistent trends for the last few years, was in mildly negative territory in here today, but it really does need to hold the $1,200 level. Now, there has been something of a change in sentiment towards social media, and Google is, I think, saddled with a social media moniker, not least because of YouTube. Well, when we look at, for example, Facebook, the self-inflicted decline that we've seen over the course of the last few months is continuing to rattle along, that the social media companies are coming under pressure both to police themselves and to monitor the addictive qualities of their apps. That is most particularly the case for some of the Chinese companies, and Tencent is pulling back again in here today, and this continues to look like a rather severe medium-term correction, if not indeed an outright top for the share. So certainly it was one of the most consistent on the upside until January of this year, and then we've had a succession of downward dynamics, a progression of lower rally highs. It is encountering well, it has pulled back below the trend mean, encountered resistance below it, and now is pulling back once more. And the Chinese government is not even remotely close to considering that companies can self-regulate, but rather it is going to enforce its own will and ensure that these companies are limited in what they can do, and that's obviously not great for either sentiment or indeed profits. And when, for example, we look at what's going on with Alibaba, then this is not a particularly bullish environment either. That it has, despite the fact that it was coming through with a 60% jump in revenue last week, analysts were focusing more on the fact that how much money it had to spend in order to achieve that goal. That a lot of the growth that it is coming through with is of lower quality. And so far, the share has sustained this move below the trend mean. Now, if it were to break below 160, well, then we'd be talking about a completed medium-term top. So this is a rather tense environment. But I think the difference in performance between the Chinese technology shares and some of the larger, the very large cap technology shares in the USA does help us to, I think it's a very clear picture on where the real strength lies, that a lot of the bullish story about China has been about the ability of some of its technology companies to expand internationally, but doors are closing left and right to Chinese international expansion, and that puts into question the rather rich valuations that have been attached to some of these companies. One thing that is quite clear is that if we look at the performance of cloud computing, then I think we're going to get some of the better performing shares that have some of the greatest potential for acceleration. This index has been rallying rather impressively now for the last 2 years, and Amazon is a significant participant in it. But Microsoft, having adopted a subscription business model and is also trying to compete in the cloud front, is also doing rather well here. Cisco Systems, having spent more than a decade going sideways, broke out to new highs in here this week. And when we look at that on a very long-term basis, we can see just how lengthy the base formation was. Well, as an infrastructure company, it is probably more attached to the fact that 5G is getting built out than any other particular factor. NetApp, for example, is a cloud computing company, and it's got a really rather similar pattern to what we're seeing with Microsoft. One of the more recent IPOs in terms of the cloud computing sector is Twilio, and that is also rallying rather impressively this year. So it is in cloud computing that we see where the focus of attention for many investors is attached, and Amazon is certainly a part of that with its Amazon Web Services. But when we think about where it is that the technology sector is heading, well, there was news this week that Google has, and through its acquisition of DeepMind, has been able to program a computer to be somewhat more intuitive and to think more like humans, to have memory, and to be able to recall its experiences. This is, I think, a major step forward in terms of artificial intelligence. It's the kinds of companies that are involved in cloud computing that are perhaps most likely to benefit from the advances that we're getting in artificial intelligence. And that is what we are seeing with the rollout of artificial intelligence, the commercialization, increasingly commercial outcomes that we have from these types of companies. There is, of course, also the fact that these kinds of companies tend to have good margins, that they have the potential for margin expansion, that once you subscribe to their cloud computing, then you're generally locked into a subscription business model. So this is, the interlinking of a business model with a new service center that is helping to drive the predictability of their revenue streams, which is contributing to the continued consistency of their trends. But none of us, when we look at all of the charts that I've been putting up over the last 5 minutes, well, we have to conclude that this is not a new story, that the pace of the advance is certainly picking up, and that it is helping to drive higher the Nasdaq 100. But the much bigger point is that the higher it goes and the wider its overextension relative to the trend mean, the greater the likelihood is that we're going to get at least some pause in consolidation. And I think that does help to really ram home the point that we are in the third psychological perception stage of this medium-term bull market, that we have now seen an economic expansion that is close to the longest in history, that the expansion has been going on for more than 10 years. It really does depend on how you want to quantify the expansion, because it's been 10 years since we've had a bear market, which would be a pullback of 20%. There was a pullback in the 1990s of 19.78%. So if you were to have a rounding error, then this one is the longest expansion. If you go with the absolutes, then the expansion in the 1990s persisted for longer than a decade. But nonetheless, we know that the market has been going up for at least 10 years. And we're now starting to see evidence of acceleration. And it's not acceleration out of a base formation. It's acceleration after an already well-developed bull market, that the pace of the advances are picking up. Well, then the big question is there evidence yet of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics? Well, when we look at the accelerations, acceleration is a trend-ending. Then it's a trend-ending of undetermined duration. So it the wider the overextension, the greater the likelihood is we're going to get a pause. The bigger the acceleration, the greater the likelihood is that we're going to have a medium-term correction. Well, then you have to think about what is the difference between a medium-term correction and a top. Well, generally speaking, a top forms when you have other factors that are falling into place. And one of the things that there's been a lot of discussion about over the course of the last few weeks and indeed months is the yield curve spread. Well, the yield curve spread has been trending lower now for the better part of 3 years already, and it's now at 23 basis points. Generally speaking, after it becomes inverted, the stock market continues to advance. So it's not, even though it is a reliable lead indicator, the lead indicator that it offers is anything from 6 to 18 months. And we're not inverted just yet. So what that suggests to me at least is that we are at a point where markets are beginning to accelerate, but they haven't finished accelerating, and that we do not have a top formation just yet, that there is potential for additional upside, not least because the S&P 500 has only just broken out. Well, that the fact is that right now you also have a strong dollar. And when we look at the dollar index, it was in positive territory in here today. It is bouncing from above the trend mean, and it has held its progression of higher reaction lows. When we just turn that around and simply look at the euro had rallied and unwound a good share of its oversold condition, but then it has now encountered resistance in the region of the progression of lower rally highs. Well, when you have a strong dollar and you have a strong stock market, then that acts as a magnet, and bull markets suck in capital from all over the world. Well, on a relative basis, Wall Street is outperforming by a considerable margin. That on a simple currency-adjusted basis, the only other market in the world that is in positive territory is Mexico this year and then Japan. Everything else is in negative territory, and China in particular is in sharply negative territory. Well, part of the reason that China is underperforming right now is because of trade wars. It's because of the weakness of the currency, but it's also because of the weakness of the banking sector. Something that's been going on in China that I think is not getting as much are nearly as much coverage as it needs to is the fact that the regional banks have been starved of capital. Well, most of the regional banks are not listed, so that means that they're difficult to monitor. But the reality is that back in 2015, and I think perhaps even earlier than that, the authorities were worried about a bubble, so in the property market, so they cut off access to liquidity for the regional banks. Then, what they did, what the regional banks did, just like what banks do normally, is they went in search of other sources of capital, and they came up with what were, I think, known locally as hedge funds, but what the hedge funds were, in fact, were private lending clubs. So they set up these private lending clubs, and these private lending clubs were being subscribed to by Communist Party apparatchiks, so therefore none of the instruments went bust or were allowed to default. Well, the size of that game exploded, so it became systemically a problem, so they started to allow defaults. Well, when they started to allow defaults and they cut off access to the private lending clubs, well, then the regional banks started issuing US dollar denominated debt, and the quantity of debt got up to about $450 billion in the space of about 18 months. And that then became systemically difficult to sustain, so they cut off access to the foreign markets, and that's why the market has been pulling back so violently over the course of this year so far. And it is most particularly pressuring the regional banks, where you have very high leverage ratios. It is not such a factor for the big banks, because the big banks were not engaged in this kind of issuance to nearly the same extent, because they didn't have the same problem with accessing liquidity from the central government. Well, now what is happening is the regional banks, they can't engage in the lending clubs anymore, and they can't issue US dollar denominated debt. So, in order to encourage deposits, what they are starting to adopt are structured products. And the structured products are being aimed directly at retail clients, and the kinds of structures that they're offering are rather fanciful. For example, they're offering structures that your capital is protected if the price of gold trades in a band between $300 and $2,500. Well, that also means that they're writing options. And in the event that you do get a kind of an outsized move in an asset class, then that does raise the specter of problems for these banks. Another structure is that they're betting on the sustainability of the Hong Kong dollar's currency peg, and that if it were to break out, that's when your capital would be at risk. Well, the Hong Kong dollar has been in a range for the last, well, I guess it's nearly 30 years. So when we look at the upper side, the price is right at the upper side of that range, and it continues to be defended. Well, in the event that they no longer defend it, that is going to represent a rather problematic event for a number of these Chinese regional banks. These kinds of structured products are exactly the kind that got banks into trouble back in 2006, but in this case it is happening in China. So these are significant issues for the financial sector. Then, of course, that's before we even begin to talk about governance. Well, the kind of things that we think about in terms of standards of governance, in terms of the independent judiciary, the freedom of the press, and property rights and respect for minority shareholder interests, don't exist in China. But on top of that, you now have a despotic regime with totalitarian tendencies, and they are becoming progressively more assertive internationally. What I find rather humorous is that China is beginning to talk about a Cold War. They're seeing the USA's attempts to impose trade tariffs as a way of trying to contain China's economic expansion. But the reality is that China has been engaged in mercantilist policies for decades and has faced absolutely no opposition. So the fact that you are now seeing some opposition is hardly grounds for saying that it is a Cold War, but that is obviously not how it is being viewed on the mainland. Now, this continued pressure that you have on the stock market is weighing on the currency. Now, they started to support the currency last week, and it has held its advance in here this week, but it is not rallying in a dynamic manner. And they may settle for simple stability. The Chinese certainly do not want a strong currency, and by the same token, they don't want it to be weakening on consecutive days either. It has already had a significant deterioration this year, and they are probably willing to support it in the region of the lows seen in 2016 and early 2017. But that doesn't, I think, obviate the potential that we're going to see a weaker currency in future. That the Chinese have got a history of using their currency as a policy tool, and that certainly remains the case. Well, China's renminbi might have fallen quite a bit, but it is not the currency that is making most headlines in here right now, despite the fact that the Argentinian peso has got a yield right now of 60%, that investors are taking some convincing that the decline in the currency is over. But 60% compounds at a rather impressive rate when it's a 7-day rate. So one would have to really be incredibly bearish about the prospect of an IMF-backed bailout failing in order to think that the currency is going to go down on consecutive weeks as quickly as it went down this week. And I think some of that rationale is beginning to be absorbed by the market in here today. We've also had a significant deterioration in the Turkish lira, and there hasn't really been a great deal of action within Turkey to really do anything to stop it. But so far it has held the 7 level, and this is the big question for Turkey, that they obviously don't have particular appetite for introducing the kind of fiscal reform that is required to even come close to balancing the books. At the same time, Turkey has is holding Europe hostage, so the likelihood is that Europe will offer at least some assistance to Turkey. Then there is the additional point that Turkey has a lot of debt that's outstanding, and that a lot of European banks hold it. So Europe has got certainly a vested interest in supporting the Turkish economy. Well, European banks remain weak, and they've been trending lower all year. This remains a consistent decline where you have one range below another, and it broke down 4 weeks ago. So this continues to look like a bearish environment. Generally speaking, Europe has got issues. And when we look at the performance of the Europe Stoxx 600, which is a pan-European index, well, I think anyone can see that it has been ranging for the last 18 months, that it's below the 400-point level, and 400 has been the upper side of what is so far an 18-year range, that it really does need to break above that 400-point level, but so far there isn't a great deal of evidence to support the argument that it is in fact going to do that. Europe has got some significant problems, not least because high yield spreads are starting to trend higher. Now, they're not trending higher in a particularly dynamic manner, but they are trending higher. And what that suggests is that the ability of companies to continue to fund themselves is starting to be pressured. It's generally speaking, after high yield spreads have been trending higher for a while, that we then get a change in terms of the ability of companies to fund themselves. Right now, yields are still relatively contained relative to history, but the reality is that interest rates in the Eurozone are still very low, and we still have the fact that the German Bund is trading at very low levels. So the fact that you're starting to get some selling pressure coming through on the high yield sector. Well, part of the reason for that is because of the change to the US tax code that multinationals, which had been warehousing money overseas, are bringing it back. They're no longer buying short-dated euro paper, and that is pushing up the yield in order to encourage other investors to do so. Then, of course, you have the fact that Europe is exposed to China more than the US is. European trade with China is quite a bit larger than the USA's, and it exports a lot more to to China. If we are indeed having an economic slowdown in China, then that is having a knock-on effect for Europe. Then, of course, you have the knock-on effect from the deterioration that's going on in Turkey, and then you have the knock-on effect that is coming through from Italy. Italy's bond yield is still investment grade, but the likelihood of that situation persisting indefinitely is, I think, running out rather quickly. But perhaps more important than all of that is the yield has first step above the base characteristics. What that suggests is that European debt markets are should be starting to get prepared for Italy to become a problem. Italy has a great deal of debt that needs to be refinanced. Its debt to GDP ratio is one of the highest in the world, and it is highly dependent on the munificence of the ECB, and the ECB's quantitative easing program is going to end in September. So when we think about the size of the ECB's balance sheet, the European Central Bank is the only central bank that did anything to reduce the size of its balance sheet from 2012, and it took $1 trillion out of circulation. Well, we can see that tapering has been underway now for a while, and the pace of the advance in the size of its balance sheet has moderated. But they've added 2.5 trillion in terms of euros to the balance sheet since 2014, and in that time, they haven't got nearly the same punch in terms of stock market performance that the USA did when it engaged in quantitative easing. The ECB has already got negative deposit rates, excuse me, and they're now starting to look at the potential to remove their stimulus. Well, European inflation came in lower than expected today. The argument that Europe is anywhere close to an inflationary problem, is, I think, risible considering the challenges that are still, I think, facing the European market. And the fact that Italy is likely to continue to represent a challenge, is something that is just not priced into, the ECB's way of thinking. Well, that we're probably going to have to see some form of big move in Italian debt to scare policymakers out of their complacency. And it does look like that's a reality. Not least now, because when you look at Europe, you've got a deteriorating situation with the banking sector. You have government bond yields in Italy starting to rise, and you have a stock market that's going nowhere. Well, what that suggests is that there is certainly room for Europe to become a problem. It was, if I think, if we thought about China as representing an additional risk premium back in January, Europe deserves an additional risk premium today. And that's perhaps a knock-on from the kind of situation that we've had in the Chinese market. And I think Europe and China are much closer interlinked than the USA and China are. Well, then let's take a look at what's going on in Japan, because Japan is still engaged in quantitative easing, and more important than that, it is still engaged in buying equities. And the buying of equities has helped to support the market. The index is now trading above the 20,000 level, and this is the first time it's been able to sustain a move above 20,000 since the early 1990s. So this is a different environment. This is something quite different, and it's a big change for Japan. And as long as it is sustaining the move above 20,000, well, we can conclude that we're still in a demand-dominated environment. The second section index, which is primarily represented by the smaller caps, has bounced impressively from the 7,000 level this week. This has been a reasonably lengthy consolidation, and so far it has been limited to a reversion to the mean. Well, as long as the second section is still trading above the trend mean, then the outlook for the Nikkei is probably going to be reasonably benign. And the Japanese yen is still holding around this 111 area. It does tend to catch a bid when you're moving into a risk-off environment. Well, we don't have a risk-off environment on Wall Street, for example, and we don't have it really in the Japanese market either, but there's certainly a risk-off environment in the emerging markets, but most particularly the emerging markets that have got very clear deteriorating standards of governance. So some witty individual has come up with the BRATS acronym. So the BRATS are the Brazilian real, and the real was a little bit firmer in here today because there's speculation that Lula da Silva will not be allowed to run for president, and the currency is right in the region of the low seen back in 2015 and 2016, so it's a natural area where we could get some consolidation, but this still remains a weak environment. Then you have the Russian ruble. Well, governance improving in Russia is almost an oxymoron at this stage. And when we look at the currency, well, it does look like the dollar has completed a first step above the base, and it is merely consolidating. The likelihood is that we're going to see additional downside. Well, we've already looked at the Argentine peso, and it really does look very oversold. And we've looked at the Turkish lira, where there are still very big questions to be asked. And then you have the South African rand. And the dollar here also looks like it is merely consolidating before moving higher. And news this week that the South African government has got a wider than expected fiscal deficit is something that is likely to weigh on the currency as well. Well, then of course you have the potential for repossessions. I don't think there's anyone who's going to argue that there is a need for some form of land reform in South Africa, but it is a very delicate subject, and it is something that is going to have to be go through due process and through the courts in order to come out with some semblance of fairness, because the I think it is a very shallow leap between the repossession of properties on a legal basis and or that is backed up by a judicial process and something that is simply a repossession and a doling out of favors to party favorites. Then, of course, one of the greatest sources of improving standards of governance is property rights. And if property rights are impinged, then where does it stop? So this is an awfully big question for South Africa. Well, the weakness of the currency and has been something of a tailwind for the stock market, but the stock market is heavily weighted by BHP Billiton, and BHP has been consolidating above the trend mean for most of the last 3 months. It really does need to continue to hold that trend mean. Well, BHP has got a significant energy component, whereas Rio Tinto is much more about iron ore and aluminium, and it is now back in the region of the progression of higher reaction lows. It has sustained so far this move below the trend mean, and this is a rather significant area where it needs to demonstrate support coming back in. The deterioration that we continue to see in copper prices is, I think, a further indication that China is the epicenter of risk right now. And the potential is that it's going to have a knock-on effect for Europe. This is not only because of a trade war. It's simply that trade war was the final thing to push it over the edge. The reality is that China has been engaged in massive debt financing for decades, and that it is starting to come towards a denouement in terms of just how much debt it can take on. The fact that the extraterritorial ambitions of Xi Jinping and the reassertion of the Belt and Road Initiative in here this week, well, no one is seeming to put a figure on exactly how much money is required to build this infrastructure. So, and the fact is that there are an increasing number of stories where China is very overtly going in and creating a debt finance trap. And I think it was John Adams had a quip to something along the lines of that there are two ways that you could engage in an imperialism. It's either with the sword or or debt. And China is definitely going down the debt route, but they're also building a blue water navy so that in the event that it needs to press its claim, that it will be able to do so. These are very clear trends. This is not something that it just started happening yesterday. The trend towards both totalitarianism and fascism in China is well developed, and that does represent a significant risk to foreign investors in the country. Well, when we look at the deterioration that we're getting in some of the industrial resources, I think that is also a reflection of what is going on in China. But it does then bear the question. When we think about the third psychological perception stage of a major bull market, then generally speaking, it is cyclicals tend to do well in the latter half of, or in the, excuse me, in the latter portion of an economic expansion. They benefit when you have synchronized global economic expansion, and we did have that, and arguably we still have almost, I think, synchronized global economic expansion. But the reality is that commodities are coming under rather severe pressure. But most particularly the industrial resources and the agricultural commodities. And when we look at, for example, what is going on in terms of soybeans, well, soybeans is a staple in China, and it remains right in the region of the lows seen back in 2008. This is a rather key level where support needs to be found for the simple reason that it represents the upper side of that very long base formation prior to the beginning of the commodity boom back in 2000, in the early 2000s. I think on the balance of probabilities, there's a strong likelihood that the 800-point level will hold. We had an upside key reversal in here today. Upside follow-through next week would, I think, give us an additional indication that the 800-point level is going to hold. Even though China is not a big consumer of coffee, the coffee price is right back at the lows seen in 2013 and 2008. And it is still below the 100-cent level. So this is a very interesting level for coffee prices, not least because they have pulled back by so much. They are so overextended relative to the trend mean, but they probably are in need of some form of catalyst. Well, the other commodity that had come back to test the upper side of a very long-term underlying base formation is lumber. And it has bounced from the 400-point level and encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. So now the question is, how long is a period of consolidation likely to last? But the more important point is whether it can hold that $400 level. And so far, it has been able to do that. There is the likelihood that when we consider the outlook for commodity prices generally, that you get big bull markets as a result of a rising cost of marginal production. And the influence of a massive source of new supply from China, or demand from China, has been a significant factor in pushing prices higher. Well, now the question is whether the marginal cost of production has risen enough to sustain prices at their current levels. And oil prices are a big arbiter in terms of that judgment, because the price of oil has not followed the trajectory that we've seen in the industrial resources or the agriculturals. The West Texas Intermediate price was above 70 for the first time in a few months in here today, but more important than that is that it holds the progression of higher reaction lows and it continues to bounce from the region of the trend mean. Brent crude has been somewhat firmer. And generally speaking, it has a more consistent trend where you have a series of ranges, one above another. And it also bounced from the region of the trend mean in here today. A sustained move back above $80 would reassert the medium-term demand-dominated environment, and it would hold out the prospect that we could see an acceleration in prices similar to what we saw in 2010. Well, that would be if energy prices were surging higher, then that would represent a headwind. That is the kind of thing that the global economy would not take particularly well. The yield curve is not inverted. Oil prices are not yet accelerating higher, at least. The US high yield spread remains contained. And this is an incredibly inert chart. Well, ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And eventually, this will break upwards. But there's no sign of it happening just yet. Some of the machinations that we're getting in the bond markets are worthy of mention. For example, the iShares iBoxx investment grade bond index. Well, it encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean in here this week, but it's lost $1 billion in terms of the quantity of money it has under management this month. Well, it's still a large fund. It still has a market cap of almost 34 billion, but that market cap was 35 billion at the beginning of this month. And what that suggests is that people are starting to take some of their money out of the bond market, that there is a lot of additional supply that is coming through, and you have a spectacular bull market going on in certain sectors of of Wall Street. Well, if we go back and think about that, a question about cyclicals, well, the commodity complex is cyclical but is not doing particularly well right now. The biotechnology sector is also cyclical. Whereas when we think about cloud computing, that is where we have the subscription business model and it basically transforms technology shares, which are historically highly cyclical, into very predictable cash flow businesses. But there's nobody buying subscriptions to biotechnology. And the fact is that the biotech sector has been out in the cold for much of the last 12 months, but it broke out to new recovery highs in here this week. It is being led higher by immuno-oncology shares. The reality is that the kinds of machines that companies like Illumina are building are reducing the cost of genetic sequencing at an exponential rate. That just last year the cost was approximately $1,000. Within the next couple of years, it will be $100. And it is the current run of machines that Illumina is producing are going to be able to achieve that feat. Well, with the collapse in the cost of genetic sequencing, that's an incredible enabler for the progress that we're seeing in terms of the biotech sector. And immuno-oncology is where the really fat profits are because of the cost of cancer care. Cancer care runs at approximately 5 to 6 trillion dollars. So these are enormous figures. And after the energy sector, healthcare is the biggest cost for the global economy. Well, if we are going to really tackle the problems from aging societies and a greater incidence of cancer, then we need to have some real strategies to deal with it. And the cost of genetic sequencing coming down is a really big part of that. Then you have CRISPR. Well, Editas is one of the companies that is vying for the intellectual property for CRISPR. Then you also have CRISPR Therapeutics. But while there is still a battle going on for exactly who holds the intellectual property to this new invention, the reality is that there isn't a genetic science lab in the world that isn't using CRISPR today. And it is incredibly enabling. It means that genetic editing is a lot faster. And what that is now leading to is further commercialization. And I think that's the primary reason that biotechnology is breaking on the upside. But on top of that, you have the fact that it's cyclical. And if we are in the latter stages of this incredibly impressive bull market, then it is time for cyclical shares to really start to show what they're capable of doing. Then I think it's also worth keeping an eye on defensives. And tobacco is about as defensive as it gets. Well, it's been pulling back in a rather violent manner over the last couple of weeks. And it's usually when the defensive sectors really start to outperform. That's when we start to see that as evidence of risk aversion. Well, consumer staples have staged a pretty impressive rally over the course of the last 4 or 5 months. Now the question is, how much of that rally are they going to be able to sustain? We certainly have evidence of is that it is the technology sector that is leading on the upside. The Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is back around the 1400 point level. It continues to hold its progression of higher reaction lows. This is very much the hardware side of things, whereas cloud computing is very much more about the software. And then you have the FANGs that are helping to drive the market higher. Well, the two shares that I have continually talked about being the canaries in the coal mine are Tesla and Netflix, because both of them are emblematic of the drive to put cheap capital to work in as prolific a manner as possible. Companies like Tesla and Netflix, they turn up in every major bull market where you have access to cheap credit allows them to take big risks. And those big risks work for a while. And then the question is whether they can get to a critical mass fast enough to be able to justify the quantity of debt that they've taken on. Well, that's a big question for Tesla, and it's an even bigger question how long Elon Musk is going to be CEO for. But it's back testing the $300 level again. One of the problems it has is that its autopilot system keeps killing people. And eventually, that is going to start gaining traction with consumers. And then, of course, there are the questions about quality, considering how quickly they have been racing to try and get production figures up. Then we have Netflix. And Netflix has bounced from the region of the trend mean, and it did so in a dynamic manner. So far, so good in terms of this was a much deserved pullback to the trend mean. It has unwound all of the overextension and now it has bounced. But something that I found is that I'm not watching Netflix as much as I used to. And I wonder how many other people feel the same way. I think that there is a cookie cutter characteristic to a lot of the kinds of programming that they're putting out, that the plot lines tend to be entirely predictable, and I tend to lose interest after not very long. So I wonder if that is something that other people are also finding. Well, if I'm not alone in that, then the chances of them being able to sustain their subscription growth is going to be called into question. Then, of course, you have the point that they've already been expanding for quite a while, and incremental new growth is going to be progressively more expensive. So, therefore, after we've had this much larger pullback, The question is it going to range for a prolonged period? And after that, will it be able to break on the upside? So I do think that the risks are rising in the high yield market. And that is something that is not yet reflected in the high yield spreads, but that doesn't mean that it won't be reflected in high yield spreads, because we know that a range is an explosion waiting to happen. Well, when we think about where are we in terms of this cycle, I continue to think we're in a secular bull market, and that certainly bull markets are occasionally punctuated by recessions. And eventually the US economy will have a recession, and considering that that is the not only the preeminent capital market but also the relative strength leader, that will have a knock-on effect for just about everywhere else. Well, I think that right now emerging markets are all being tarred with the same brush, that the Indian market is going through a digital transformation, and the stock market continues to represent relative strength in the emerging market sector. The Thai market has been completely out of the headlines, but it continues to hold its move above the trend mean. Well, today the Indonesian rupiah came under some selling pressure, but and it is moving to a new all-time low, but it is not accelerating lower. And the Jakarta Composite has been trading in the region of the trend mean, and it was well off its lows in here today. I think this is where these are the kinds of places where we're going to see opportunities arising from the difficulties that we see in a lot of other of the emerging markets. It is primarily in the ASEAN region where you have growth and demographics in your favor, and from the perspective of a longer term investor, and it's also generally speaking where we have improving standards of governance. When we think about what it is that can drive a secular bull market, well, we have the fact that you do have massive and exponential growth in the technology sector, that there are new ways of doing things, new products, new systems, and new therapies that are being employed that on an individual basis are powerful enough to drive a secular bull market, but that they are happening at such a rapid pace and across an increasingly large number of sectors, from healthcare to computing to artificial intelligence to genetic editing, energy, storage, production. These are all driving a secular bull market hypothesis. And against that background is the fact that we have had extraordinarily low interest rates for quite a long time already, and that access to extraordinarily cheap liquidity is starting to go away. Well, that is going to put pressure on the most heavily levered strategies. But the secular bull market is unlikely to be particularly influenced by that. The pace of exponential technological innovation is not in line with the financial cycle or the business cycle, and that is, I think, a significant factor. Then you have the rise of the global consumer, and the fact that you still have improving governance in major young population centers like India and Indonesia, and you have Africa coming off of a very, very low base, but also having the highest population growth figures. These are the kinds of things that will help to boost the global consumer base over the longer term. Then you also have the revolution that's going on in energy. And generally speaking, when you get a revolution in energy and in healthcare, these are the kinds of factors that can drive productivity growth over the long term. Well, eventually we will have a recession, and that will set up truly attractive buying opportunities. In the meantime, we're in a momentum-driven market, and there is no real sign yet that that momentum is over. So that is also when it is generally easiest to make money. As long as we retain our emotional equilibrium, there is the potential for these markets to accelerate higher. And that's likely to persist until we have evidence of top formation, which is not readily apparent. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.